From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. This is Here and Now. Russia intends to take full control of eastern and southern Ukraine. That's according to a senior general today. Outside Mariupol in the east, satellite images reveal what Ukrainian officials say is a mass grave. Today is Good Friday for Orthodox Christians, and this week the UN Secretary General had called for a ceasefire starting yesterday. Moscow said no. So Orthodox Christians in Ukraine are preparing for Easter under fire, as Ukrainian churches in the United States and elsewhere are sending money and support. So let's talk now to Boris Gudziak, Metropolitan Archbishop of Philadelphia for Ukrainian Catholics in the United States. Archbishop, welcome.
It's good to be with you, Scott.
There have been ceasefires in the past during religious periods, say during Ramadan in the Yemen civil war. This is Holy Week in the Orthodox Church. What do you make of the Russian response rejecting the requested ceasefire?
Well, I would say that Holy Week is not that important. I mean, winning the war, prosecuting the war, continuing the killing is a priority.
Yeah. Well, in Russia, the head of the Russian Orthodox Church, Patriarch Kirill, has long been an ally of President Putin, and he has presented a Christian icon to a Russian commander in this war. What, in your view, is the role of a religious leader in a time like this?
Well, he's done more than just present an icon. It's been years where he's been formulating ideological constructs that have supported Putin's recreation of empire and colonization of neighbors. And he's come out very clearly supporting what the soldiers are doing with no criticism of any of the war crimes. So religious leaders are called to summon people to respect God-given dignity, to respect each other, to not sin. And the greatest sin is mass violence. War is something that devastates. It's something that leaves scars for generations. My parents were refugees from the communists leaving the Soviet Union territory in 1944. And our whole family's life was you know, conditioned by the atrocities of the Nazis and the Soviets. And this is happening right now, and it's unconscionable. It's scandalous that a religious leader supports this.
So for you, Archbishop, how has this war challenged or perhaps strengthened your own personal faith?
Well, I think it does challenge my faith. It makes you focus. People are riveted to what is happening in Ukraine. One reason is because they're seeing people willingly sacrificing their lives to protect the innocent. Jesus teaches that there's no greater love than when one gives one's life for one's friends. That's in John 15:13. And we see that being done by thousands of people. Hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians have come back to Ukraine from other countries to defend the country. We see great willingness to sacrifice oneself. At the same time, the question of evil arises. How can it be that such carnage occurs? Can God interfere? And here we see what a terrible, terrifying gift our freedom is. If we misuse our freedom, these are free decisions being made by Putin, but not only Putin. You know, thousands of Russians are involved in this. 700 university presidents signed a document of support of President Putin's policies in Russia. The church is behind it. This is something that really can shake us. And yet we saw that Jesus was quite alone when he was being crucified. So truth can sometimes be lonely.
Can I ask you to put this war into a broader context of hostilities against Ukrainian churches over time? I mean, how do you zoom out the frame for us to contextualize this?
Well, in the 20th century, 15 million people were killed in Ukraine. It, from 1933 to 1945, it was the most dangerous place on Earth. If you take a bigger chunk of time, in the past 250 years, every time there's a Russian occupation of a part of Ukraine where Ukrainian Catholics live and minister, the Ukrainian Catholic Church gets strangled. It's a shock for Ukrainians, but it's not a surprise. And over the last decades, when Ukraine wanted to become a member of the European Union and NATO, this desire was motivated by the fact that a plurality of Russians believe that they have the right to rule over Ukraine and that Ukrainians should submit to the cultural, political, religious policies of the imperial center. So this is something that needs to be cured at its root. The imperialism and colonialism that is kind of embedded in Russian identity needs to somehow be cured. Otherwise, this will carry on to future centuries.
Yeah. And as you see it, being enabled by the Russian Orthodox Church, yeah?
Well, unfortunately, most Christian churches now are rethinking and repenting for their role in empire building or colonialism. The Russian Orthodox Church has not arrived at that point.
Hmm. That's Boris Gudziak, Metropolitan Archbishop of Philadelphia for Ukrainian Catholics in the United States. Archbishop, thank you very much for the time and our best to your flock.
Thank you. Thank you for your support of the suffering people of Ukraine.
And there was more violence today at the holy sites in Jerusalem. Dozens of Palestinians were injured by Israeli police who fired rubber bullets and stun grenades inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Police say they were responding to crowds of Palestinians throwing rocks and fireworks. This is the latest in a series of clashes between Israelis and Palestinians that have raised fears of a bigger conflict, like last year's war in Gaza. NPR's Peter Kenyon joins us now from Jerusalem. Hi, Peter.
Hi.
So today's violence is really a step back from last Friday when more than 150 Palestinians and several Israeli police officers were injured in similar clashes at this same site. What's the feeling like today?
Well, compared with last Friday, the arrests were down, but these mornings of tense confrontations have been going on all of Passover Holy Week here. There's been rock-throwing Palestinians, Israeli police moving in with rubber bullets. Today there was gas dropped from a drone. So a less dramatic Friday isn't necessarily cause to think this is winding down. I will say that after the tense morning, I witnessed an extremely large but entirely peaceful crowd bust in from around the country, Palestinians attending Friday prayers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Now, on the other hand, this afternoon at the mosque site, people could be seen with Hamas flags, so I wouldn't say things have completely calmed down.
This month has seen this rare convergence of Jewish, Christian, and Muslim holidays all coming together at the same time. Now, authorities had prepared because of that for the possibility of violence. But if you could just take a step back for a moment and tell us why this is happening.
Well, some Palestinians would say it happened because the Israeli government authorized the police to escort right-wing Jewish groups into these sensitive holy sites during Ramadan. It is Passover Holy Week for Jews as well, of course, and many Jewish Israelis absolutely defend their right to visit their holy site, the Temple Mount. But many Palestinians saw the way it was handled as a desecration of what they consider holy ground, and younger Palestinians showed their anger with the rock throwing.
If we look back at last May, this is the same site where there was violence that triggered a war. Is there concern that what we're seeing today could escalate into that?
Well, certainly some commentators are speculating about that worst-case possibility. Others suggest it's not nearly to that point yet. We should note, though, that this week three rockets were fired from the Hamas-led Gaza Strip into Israel, and the Israeli military responded with airstrikes into Gaza. Now, last year, there were similar clashes in the West Bank, similar rocket fire from Gaza, and it wound up turning into an 11-day war between Israeli forces and Gaza militants, with Hamas firing thousands of rockets, Israel conducting hundreds of airstrikes. Some 200 Palestinians were reported killed, more than a dozen Israelis. Many here are hoping that scenario won't be repeated.
What are you hearing from both Israeli and Palestinian authorities about what happens next? Are they trying to, avoid that? ease tensions?
Well, there's been efforts to get things de-escalated. Two State Department officials were here, met with Israeli and Palestinian leaders, but there wasn't any immediate announcement of de-escalation or an end to the clashes. Israel's Foreign Minister Yair Lapid said in a statement, he told the Americans Israel's just trying to preserve the status quo at the Temple Mount. The Palestinian authorities, Mahmoud Abbas, was quoted as saying Israel was responsible and Washington should intervene. Now, Secretary of State Antony Blinken's also spoken with senior officials in Jordan about the need for Israelis and Palestinians to try working together to end the violence and protect the holy sites. But for now, most of the people I've spoken with here expect a similar cycle of rock-throwing Palestinians and Israeli police in riot control mode to continue tomorrow, and there's no sign it will stop there.
That is NPR's Peter Kenyon reporting from Jerusalem. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For more than 50 years, Disney World in Florida has enjoyed a special status that lets it govern itself. It decides whether to build roads. It has its own fire department. But it may be the end for this small world. Florida lawmakers voted to eliminate this district. It's an explicit retaliation in the culture wars. Disney opposed the bill, now a law, that bars the teaching of sexual orientation and gender identity in schools. Robin Farzad is our tour guide for this one. He's the host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Robin, hey.
How are you?
I'm well. So help us understand, what was the point in the first place back in 1967 for this special tax district for Disney?
If you think about it, everything that has to be done, and you're talking to a lapsed Florida man, a longtime Florida man who always had the responsibility of taking those relatives to the Magic Kingdom and Epcot Center. It was quite an ordeal, but Disney is, it's kind of its own empire down there. If you're building something, it's not kind of the World's Fair just coming through. This is landfill capabilities, sewerage, I mean, vulture abatement, hotels, infrastructure.
All
city
that.
Got, you know, they got this special treatment back in 1967, specifically on the promise that over decades we're going to be a city unto ourselves and we're going to have a huge workforce here and we're going to bring so much in tax revenue. And I don't think they ever imagined that, especially with how successful the corporation has been, that the governor would summarily kind of turn around and revoke it.
Yeah. Now, this gender law, now a bill, it was a signature a bill for Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, Republican, presumed presidential aspirant. Are there big business implications here for Disney, or is this just a bit of political theater?
You know, I like the political theater element of it, just kind of watching it. If you look at it in terms of brinksmanship and what's at stake for either side, yeah, Disney, it's a huge thing. I mean, both for taxpayers, if the kind of the bonds that would have to revert to private taxpayers that Disney had backed, the shortfall of tax revenue that would revert to, I mean, that would all be disastrous for any lawmaker, Republican or Democrat. But just the theater of taking on Disney as a GOP 2024 aspirant is probably very ripe for DeSantis. I mean, this all could be scuppered in court or through legislation. And Disney certainly has no shortage of you know, $400 an hour attorneys who could kind of knock it down. But if you're DeSantis and you're playing to the Fox News primary, look, you've taken on one of the most powerful corporations on the planet. It has had affiliations with kind of LGBTQ friendliness, and it's very ripe if you're going to go into Iowa with that.
Now, let me ask you a little bit more about the people who live in these counties near Disney. There's talk, and you've made reference to it, that they might have to pick up the slack for this tax burden, wastewater treatment, public safety, all the stuff you talked about.
Yeah, Reedy Creek, this special city, this special entity, I mean, is on the hook for about $1 billion in long-term bond debt, right? Disney currently pays property and other taxes to the counties that are involved here, and about $150 million in revenues from taxes that district collected last year. Look, it pays about 400 employee salaries. Disney has 60,000 to 80,000 employees in the area. It's very hard to kind of wrest the bone from the dog's mouth in this case.
All right, let's step back for a second and talk about what this suggests, this moment suggests for big corporations. For a long time, they were friendly with conservatives, at least country club Republican conservatives. But now these culture war conservatives seems like a different story that big corporations have to pay attention to.
I really wonder what the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is thinking about this, right? And kind of the country club conservatives versus kind of the red meat far-right conservative in this case. Look, you've had examples happen in North Carolina with trans bathrooms and other states pulling out. You've had examples in other states with various abortion legislation going on now in the South and in Dixie. Never have you seen a governor directly take on a corporation of this size and this heft. I mean, it is a multinational. And again, the asymmetry in it is not like Disney can just pick up and build Walt Disney World and Epcot Center in Colorado overnight. He knows that they have no choice. This is a long-term asset, and they can't just hightail out of town. It's not a conference. It's not a concert series. It's not a kind of a live podcast show like others who've been boycotting Florida and Texas and other places.
Yeah, and super quick, there is still time for a compromise or for this to potentially be struck down, yeah?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's going to have to go through legislation. It's going to, the governor could sign it, but then when the states have to come back or the special district has to opt out, there has to be a majority of people who represent that district, and they are Disney people after all.
Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott.
And it is a smaller world after all for streaming platforms. Let's start with CNN Plus.
Back to Who's Talking.
I'm Sarah Seidner, and this is Big Picture.
I'm Evan McMorris Santoro in Bloomfield, New Jersey.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Kate Baldwin.
Let's get straight to the source.
Those were just a few of the big-name journalists who launched the inaugural lineup for CNN's new streaming service just 3 weeks ago. And yesterday, after investing hundreds of millions of dollars in the project, CNN announced it will shut it down at the end of the month. Let's bring in NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, good to have you back.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So maybe this is telling. I signed up for CNN Plus a few weeks ago, and I still haven't used it. What exactly went wrong?
Well, I don't think the shutdown is connected to whether or not people used it or how many subscribers they got. This was a much bigger decision than that. There was a basic disagreement between the people that used to run the company that developed CNN Plus and the people who took over the company earlier this month in this new outfit called Warner Brothers Discovery. And once those new leaders decided that they didn't want to have a standalone service, they pretty much decided to pull the plug quickly and let everyone who was involved with this, and we're talking hundreds of employees, know that they were going to change focus and that things were going to be very different going forward.
So I hear you that it might have been an issue just of bad timing, but with so much money invested into this project to get it off the ground, to recruit those top names that you just referred to, why pull the plug so fast without at least seeing if it could work out?
Well, I mean, this is a very basic difference in strategy that is really important at a time when the new leadership is taking over the company, which has something like $3 billion in debt, right? So they already have a huge amount of debt. And this other leadership committed to this standalone streaming service that the new people who are running the company didn't want and doesn't think is wise. And in order for them to keep it going, they'd have to spend even more money on it. So, I think what they probably should have done was not launch it. They probably should have waited, let the new leadership take over and let them decide what to do with it. But instead, they launched it probably in an effort to say, it's already out there. You might as well invest in it. And the new leadership said, you know what? We're not doing that.
Well, it must be a wound for the people involved. Chris Wallace came over from Fox News, Audie Cornish from NPR, hundreds of editors, producers hired to make these shows. What happens to them?
Well, you know, they announced yesterday some measures so that, you know, people would have time to find new jobs if that's inside the company, if that's what they wanted. Something like 3 months of pay and benefits, and, you know, they're going to get severance if they leave the company. And, you know, I'm hearing that the big stars who were hired, they're going to find places for them to work inside CNN. It's very likely. But there are still hundreds of people who will probably lose their jobs. Now, it was expected that the new ownership would come in and cut positions anyway, because again, $3 billion in debt. So they were going to have to streamline operations at CNN anyway. But I think launching CNN Plus right before new owners took over just made the transition even tougher. And now they have to very publicly sort of walk back this initiative and figure out what to do with all these folks who got hired thinking that they were going to be working on the standalone streaming service, when what the new leaders want to do is create an online platform that would include all of their brands. I mean, the brands that they have now include TNT, TBS, Cartoon Network, HBO. So they're going to be looking for something that kind of encompasses all of those brands in one platform. And CNN Plus was not that.
None of this is happening in a vacuum. This week, for the first time in a decade, Netflix reported a drop in subscribers. Are there any connections that you can make between what's happening at Netflix and now at CNN Plus about the future of streaming?
Well, I think what we saw Wall Street doing up until now was pouring money into streaming services, investing in them with the idea that eventually they would grow. Some of them would grow big enough to turn a profit. And so what's happening to Netflix is that it's no longer sort of the golden child of the media industry. And people have sort of said, you know, wow, you know, you've in the past predicted constant growth, and now you're not growing. What's going on here? So I think what's happened at CNN Plus, again, is another company saying, look, we have to be very specific and very focused and very careful about what we're doing in the streaming space. And we can't just spend hundreds of millions of dollars on something that might or might not work, especially if we don't believe in it. It's going to be a tougher time for the streaming world. And over the next year, I think we're going to see some shakeout. We're going to see some streamers have to get out of the business because they can't get the numbers they need to attract the support from Wall Street investors that they need to survive.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, thank you very much. Have a great weekend.
All right, same to you.
European governments are debating whether to stop buying natural gas from Russia. But for now, Zurich, Switzerland is already shutting off gas to some neighborhoods. It's part of its plan to curb climate change. Dan Charles reports.
Officials in Zurich announced just over 10 years ago that they wanted to decommission gas pipelines in a chunk of the city with close to 100,000 people. Reinhard Schöne from the city's gas company says many people weren't quite ready for it.
Da war das schon ein Schock.
It was a shock, he says. But officials wanted to promote a different source of energy. Extra heat from a waste incinerator on the edge of the city. It's a modern plant with all the latest pollution controls. And it also heats water, which then circulates through underground pipes to homes and businesses. This is called district heating. And Zurich's energy commissioner, Sylvia Bonfey-Frost, says it made no sense to run hot water and gas pipelines side by side.
It's quite clear that we don't want to have parallel networks for supplying heat.
Some city residents protested because the switch from gas could be expensive. So officials promised to compensate anybody who had to discard a new gas furnace, and they delayed the shutdown by 5 years. But now it's happening. Connecting to the district heating system is impossible for some people, though, especially those who live in single-family homes, like Ernst Donner, a member of Zurich's city parliament. He and his neighbors have switched to electric heat pumps, basically reverse air conditioners, delivering heat, not just cooling.
Those I know are very happy with their heat pump. It's very good.
Mohammed Ali, a chef at a Lebanese restaurant called Simsim, is less pleased. He's been cooking with gas.
Actually, gas, it's nice, you know, to cook, to feel, to give power.
He's installing electric induction stoves in his restaurant. Unlike old-style electric stoves, with these you can turn the heat up and down instantly, more like gas. They work fine, he says, but they cost $40,000. And for him, there were few subsidies.
I'm just so angry because we have to pay a lot of money and the city not helping, you know.
Year by year, gas will disappear from more neighborhoods. The plan is, by 2040, nobody in Zurich will be burning what city officials call fossil gas. And Rainer Schöne from the gas company says most people in Zurich are now on board with this, to fight climate change and also to stop buying gas from Russia.
Da hat sich die Einstellung noch mal dramatisch
Attitudes have changed once again, dramatically. Today it's clear, people have to and want to get away from fossil gas.
Zurich is blazing a trail that other cities around the world may follow. Many, like San Jose, California, are encouraging individual households to switch from gas to electric appliances. Carrie Romanow, Director of Environmental Services for San Jose, says they're focused on the equipment that burns the most gas.
We're not so worried about your gas cooktop, right, or your gas clothes dryer, as we are about heating and water heating, because those are much bigger uses.
If they succeed, though, they could end up in a situation similar to Zurich's, with an expensive gas system that serves fewer and fewer customers. And that could mean a heavier financial burden on people who can least afford the new electric alternatives. Romanow says it would be up to the gas company, in this case Pacific Gas and Electric, to decide when shutting down gas pipelines makes economic sense. A spokesperson for PG&E declined to say whether the company is thinking about this possibility. For NPR News, I'm Dan Charles.
One night recently here in Phoenix, a college student named Kylie Higgins was house-sitting with a friend. She parked her Hyundai Santa Fe overnight on the street, and the next morning,
I try to start my car, and I noticed it has a really weird, like, noise. And I was like, what is that? Like, I had no gas. So I was like, maybe it's just because I have no gas.
It wasn't the gas.
I turned it off and started again, and it still has a super funky, weird noise.
It sounds like there's no muffler.
Around the same time, a few miles away, Greg Nelson and his girlfriend woke up on a Sunday morning to the same problem. Something was wrong with the Toyota Prius.
It's a very high boom, 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 just like a motorcycle, but I would probably equate it to a Harley Davidson. If you've ever been around a car that doesn't have a catalytic converter, it's pretty obvious once you start thinking about it.
Mystery solved. In both cases, a thief snuck under the vehicle and stole the catalytic converter. Most cars have them to control the exhaust, and all across the country, they are getting stolen at an alarming rate. Joining us now is David Glowey. He heads up the National Insurance Crime Bureau. This is a group that's been tracking this problem. David, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
So let me share a stat here that I think will help people understand how quickly this is escalating. In 2018, the New York City Police Department said 200 catalytic converters were reported stolen. Last year, it was nearly 4,000. What's going on? Are you seeing this kind of spike in other places too?
Yeah, we're seeing a nationwide spike. Really, it accelerated during the COVID-19 pandemic. And the reason for that is there's precious metals that are inside a catalytic converter that are very rare. And investors during times of crisis gravitate towards investing in these. So the price for these precious metals to be stolen or extrapolated out of the catalytic converters is very valuable.
Wow. So apparently a thief can just slip right under the car, take it out very quickly. How do they do it?
Yeah, it's relatively simple. It requires just a reciprocating saw or a saw, which can be battery operated. You slide under the car, slice through your exhaust system, and you're in and out usually within 30 seconds to a minute.
And then what do they do with it? They sell it for scrap. How much money can they get?
Yeah, it's a multi-step process. So you have the thief that steals the catalytic converter and then sells it to a scrap metal yard, usually for $150 to $300. Then that's sold to another party that actually extrapolates the precious metals out of it. And then it's recycled into different parts. And the price per ounce is just gone up exponentially since COVID-19. So it's very valuable throughout that entire supply chain.
It's so interesting because we're talking at such a local level, right? Somebody literally is on your street corner, slips underneath the car, and then sells this metal. But globally, if we look at it from a big picture, what's happening that's driving all of this?
Yeah, it's a great question. So prior to taking this position, I was the Undersecretary for Intelligence at the Department of Homeland Security up until 2020. And we look at supply chain issues that impact the United States. And the precious metals that are contained in catalytic converter, which are ferrohidium, platinum, and palladium, are primarily produced in two countries, Russia and South Africa. So you've had the issue with Ukraine and the supply chain issues that have been disrupted, the sanctions involving Russia. And then you've had the COVID-19 supply chain that's impacted South Africa. The totality of that is impacting the supply chain for these precious metals to be produced into catalytic converters.
Wow. I want to play one more piece of tape from Kylie Higgins, who says that her bosses at the gym where she works have told the employees to move their cars when they come to work.
They were saying that if you park in a specific area, it's common for people to get their catalytic converters stolen. So now we have to park in a specific area for our cars to be safe.
So that's what Kylie is doing. I know some mechanics are painting them orange to make them more conspicuous or even putting cages around these devices. What should people be doing to protect themselves and their cars?
So we work with the manufacturers of all the auto manufacturers to look at crime prevention and the emerging trends. So we are sponsoring programs for VIN etching, the vehicle identification number that all vehicles have, to put those on catalytic converters that can be done aftermarket. There are aftermarket club-like devices that can actually encompass the catalytic converter, makes it more difficult to steal. But then also good personal security. Park your car in a well-lit area. If you have a parking garage, put it in a parking garage. Engage with the local crime prevention programs. It's a holistic approach. And there's also numerous legislation that's pending in states right now to address catalytic converter thefts, including at the federal level.
I noticed that, including here in Arizona, there's a law where they're considering stiffening the penalties or trying to better regulate the black market. Do you think this is a big enough problem that it needs a legislative solution?
Well, we're seeing that across the country. So we are helping draft the legislation with Congressman Baird out of Indiana for federal legislation on this. And we're tracking 65 bills right now, which we are helping the states and different legislators craft the right language, because there's really, this is a property crime with a very little deterrent effect, but it's affecting the public and the communities at large tremendously.
David Glawi heads up the National Insurance Crime Bureau, talking about the theft of catalytic converters. David, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
It's springtime. Trees are budding, birds are chirping right outside my window. You might be able to hear them. And skiers are face planting into giant icy pools of water. By design, there's an image for you. Colorado Public Radio's Stina Sieg says pond skimming, as it's known, is back after a pandemic hiatus.
It's the last day of skiing at Powderhorn Mountain Resort in western Colorado. An overcast sky as thick as whipped cream hovers over a crowd gathered around a steep slope. At the bottom, a long, man-made pond, about 100 feet of cold water. The snowboarder Ryan Robinson stands at the top, then zooms down and attempts to skim across the surface. He makes it about 3/4 of the way before slowing to a stop. I ask Robinson, who works for Powderhorn, what was going through his head as he started to sink.
I thought I should have worn thicker socks.
He's not just the first pond skimmer of the day, but the first in 3 years here. Because of the pandemic, ski areas haven't held these events since 2019. Sarah Lubin, who teaches adaptive skiing, is happy pond skims have returned.
It's the glory. So you don't win anything out of it, but the idea that you make it across and you look cool doing it sounds awesome.
Lubin looks in her element, smiling in a carnival-inspired mask with big feathers and zebra leggings. She's been pond skimming for years, mostly with success, and she's one of about 75 people taking on the challenge this afternoon in tutus and business suits and Hawaiian shirts and at least one Tigger onesie. About half fall into the water, a foreboding yellow-green. But Lubin's one of the lucky ones. While the history of pond skimming is about as hazy as an unfiltered IPA, many people trace it back to Alberta, Canada, in the late 1920s. Legend goes that two friends were enjoying a day of spring skiing when they encountered a newly formed pool of melted snow.
One of them, I'm sure, asked the other to hold his beer as he tried to skim across.
Kendra Scarfield, with the resort Banff Sunshine Village, says one made it, the other plunged into the cold. Her resort has been holding pond skims, which they call slush cups, near the same spot for more than 90 years. But she's only tried it once, and crashed.
And it was the coldest I have ever been in my entire life. And I'm Canadian, so that's saying a lot.
Over the generations, the mix of pain and pride that pawn skimming promises has rippled all over the world, often reserved for the frenzy that is that final day of the season, including at Steamboat Ski Resort in Steamboat Springs on a recent freezing Sunday. Dressed as Superman, Jeremy Monahan emerges with a shocked look and a big grin. Like everyone here today, he did not make it all the way across. But he says pond skimming is about much more than that.
Really just that like crowd enthusiasm, everybody celebrating the end of a great year.
Steamboat employee Dallas Elmore was one of the first to try out the course this morning, then changed into dry clothes to watch.
After 2 years of not normal, it's nice to have people out and smiling and just being happy.
Doing something not everyone would dare to.
You know, skiing is a little bit inherently dangerous, but life without a little risk is not really a life, so people get a chance to jump in and...
be joyfully wacky and weird and very, very cold. For Here and Now, I'm Stina Sieg.
All right, Peter, do you know the origins of that old saw, I am no spring chicken?
I do not. Although you're right about that, Scott, you are no spring chicken.
Oh, point to Peter O'Dowd. Spring chicken means someone no longer young. And centuries ago, chickens born in the spring were considered more tender. So when farmers tried to unload their older winter chickens, the buyers were like, wait a second.
Ah, that's right. That's no spring chicken, mister.
There you go.
There's a reason we're talking about this, people. Hang tight.
The reason is Kathy Gunst is here, our resident chef here to talk about chicken dishes this season. Kathy, you're back. Hello.
I am back. I am also no spring chicken.
That makes three of us. So, Kathy, what are these spring chicken recipes you're talking about? Do you need these young chickens to make them?
You do not. I mean, if you have a local farmer who is... what do they call it? Harvesting chicken this time of year? It would be great, but you can use any type of chicken. And the thing that distinguishes these three recipes is that they are lighter and greener than your winter prep of maybe a roast chicken or chicken parmesan. And these use all kinds of fresh herbs and greens and bok choy. And I love all of them.
And Kathy, I have to talk about your recipe you sent over yesterday for braised chicken. We made it at home last night. Braised chicken with fresh leeks, artichokes, spring herbs. Oh my goodness, so tender. Tell us about it.
Scott, I'm so impressed with you. Scott sent me a photo today. It looked spot on. This is a very delicate, almost spring-like dish where you use chicken thighs or breasts, you brown them, and then to braise them means that it's in liquid, a stock, but you don't cover them. It's not like a soup. The stock cooks down with leeks, bottled marinated artichokes, garlics, and then I add parsley, chives, tarragon, and thyme. And this is just, it's very satisfying, right? And comforting, but also kind of spring-like and light.
It's so light. My parents were over, and they loved it. I mean, it just kind of melts in your mouth the way this recipe works. So I didn't get all the fresh herbs I needed here. Could not find tarragon, went to two stores, and only had half of the fresh parsley. So with the full fresh herbs, you know, how much better would it be?
Yeah, just a bit brighter, but I'm still giving you an A+. I'm so impressed that you did it. It's just great. And
I'll take it. My GPA needs work. Thank you.
Okay, good, good. You're on. All right. Next, you have to make chicken Milanaise, okay?
Yeah, let's do it. Tell us about that one.
This will be a favorite, too. Essentially, you take a chicken breast, and don't get scared of this, you cut it in half. You push down with one hand, take a sharp knife, and you cut horizontally. And then you pound it with a meat pounder. You could use a wine bottle, an olive oil thing. You just want to get it thin. You also can now buy pounded chicken cutlets, and you very lightly dip it into flour and then beaten eggs and then crispy panko breadcrumbs. And the chicken is shallow fried, not deep fried, in olive oil until it's crispy on the outside, but really tender inside. So you get this crunchy chicken cutlet, but you then top it with spicy arugula leaves that you've tossed in balsamic vinegar and olive oil, and then thin shavings of Parmesan cheese. So you get all these really bright, intense flavors with a great texture.
And before we get to the last one, I just want to clarify, when you say cut that chicken breast in half, you mean sort of the thin way, right? So it butterflies out?
Absolutely. Thank you, Peter. Yes, you want to make two thin cutlets from one chicken breast. Exactly.
All right. Sounds great. Now, you have a stir fry in mind. Go over that one. And, you know, do people need to have a wok in order to make this dish, first of
all? You don't need a wok. But it will be better if you have a cast iron skillet or a heavy skillet. My dear friend Grace Young, who wrote the beautiful book Breath of a Wok, talks about getting a wok hot enough. Wok hay, it's called, it's the life force. So you heat a wok or a skillet till it's very hot. You've marinated, again, chicken breasts or thighs with a bit of soy sauce and cornstarch and ginger and a little bit of Chinese black vinegar or rice wine vinegar. Stir fry it with bok choy, which are small, almost cabbage-looking Asian greens, and they are crunchy and bright. And you add scallions, and then at the end you add salted peanuts. So we're always going for texture and color and flavor and brightness. And all three of these chicken dishes use completely different techniques and flavor profiles, but they all share that brightness.
Yeah. And Kathy, couple seconds. Any advice on how to pick chicken at the store?
Fresh, they're labeled. Check, make sure the date is good. If you have a local farmer, go that route. And if you can, buy organic.
Kathy Gunst is a resident chef at Here and Now, and her recipes are at hereandnow.org. Kathy, thank you as always. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. Great to talk to you both.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. It's Here and Now.